Welcome to the Property Voice Podcast, helping you to navigate safely through the world of property investing. Get the lowdown and updates, insights and outcomes on all matters property with a splash of entertainment along the way. The Property Voice, a voice to trust among the crowd. Now, let's get started with your host, Richard Brown.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Property Voice podcast. My name is Richard Brown and it's a privilege to have you join me today. Now you might be expecting to hear from Kaza. However, she's not going to be here this week, unfortunately. I think she might have gone for a reboot or something like that. So do you like having Kaza on the show? She did mention last week that she got some fan mail. Perhaps that explains where she is this week. Who knows? Wherever you are right now, Kaza, I hope you're having fun. Okay, so what have we got coming up for you on today's show then? As usual, we've got Property Chatter, where we'll be looking at ways of evaluating a property investment deal together. Then we have a listener question from Andy, who left us a voicemail on SpeakPipe, which is freshly installed on our website. Finally, we have the shout-out, where we'll direct you to a very impressive young chap that is aiming at achieving financial independence at the age of 30. Now, when I tell you, he originally set the target age of financial independence at 37 and a half. He's revised that down a couple of times now. So he's really quite an inspirational guy, I believe. So stick around and we'll point you in his direction. Okay then, let's get started.
Okay, so let's get on with this week's featured topic with Property Chatter.
Today's topic is property investing criteria and calculations. And let's start by quoting one of the most famous marketing gurus of all time. Peter Drucker said, "What gets measured gets managed." And so what we're going to look at today is how to decide if an investment is a good one or not. We're going to look at some criteria and some key performance indicators, or KPIs for short. And if you're following along in the Property Investor Toolkit, my book, today's episode aligns with section 2 of that book. Now in business, there are many performance management methodologies that could be adopted. The balanced business scorecard, goals and objectives, sales figures, customer and employee satisfaction, and so on and so on. And of course the question is, why? Well, the reason is, as Peter Drucker said, if it then gets managed, and what gets managed gets done. So having a focus on key performance indicators allows us to keep our hands and on the business and control what we're doing and effectively achieve the objectives we set for ourselves. Now in our last couple of episodes, we looked at high-level strategy and principles, flying at 30,000 feet if you like. Today we're going to get much closer to ground zero by understanding and knowing what a good deal is for us and what it isn't. And in order to do that, we need to set ourselves some KPIs, these key performance indicators, and some deal criteria. So let's start with these KPIs, or key performance indicators. I'll use the term KPIs from now onwards. Now in property, there's several different measures, in fact quite a lot really, I found, that we could adopt in terms of property investing. Just some of them are gross yield, net yield, capital growth, net monthly cash flow, return on investment, time to rent or time to sell, our debt coverage ratio or return on debt, net equity gain, price per square foot or square meter, the after refurb value, tenant buyer demand and payback period, just to name a dirty dozen. There's a lot more I could have mentioned as well, but I think you get the idea. There's plenty to choose from. I'm not proposing that there aren't necessarily others you should consider, but equally, I'm not necessarily proposing that you adopt all of these as measures either. I am proposing you adopt some measures and define what's most important to you in terms of determining what makes a good deal and what isn't. I would say the main metrics in property investment, certainly as far as this exercise is concerned, tend to be yield, and that's either gross or net yield. Various ways of looking at return on investment. Return on cash investment is what I particularly like to look at, but equally we'll have a look at return on debt and return on works as well, which are different measures that I tend to use. Net monthly cash flow, how much money is left in our hands after paying all our bills, both direct and indirect, and that's an important distinction. Net equity gain or profit, especially on buy, refurbish and refinance deals or indeed flips. And there's another one called Payback. And this is always worth looking at, as it tells us how long we have to go before we get our initial investment return back to us. I do look at other factors as I undertake my full due diligence in a deal, such as tenant demand, time to let, and so on. However, when screening a deal at the top level, these are the metrics that I use the most. And let's have a look at some of these metrics now in more detail. Starting with yield, as I mentioned, there's gross yield and net yield. Gross yield is the total annual rent before any deductions divided by the current property valuation. Now, some people vary that bottom half of the equation to put the purchase price in, for example. But I always use the current property valuation in my own example because it gives me something a little bit more up to date in order to evaluate the performance of my investment. Obviously, purchase prices change. They normally go up over time. Sometimes they go down. But having the purchase price as the measure is not going to help us over the long term. So I always use the current property valuation. Net yield, on the other hand, basically takes the total rent and then deducts all of the operating costs from that figure and then divides it by the current property valuation. So we've got two variations there. And by definition, as you probably gathered, gross yield is quite a crude measure because by definition it ignores all of our costs. And so if we were to use a measure of yield, I would probably suggest we use net yield instead of gross yield. We could have two identical properties, for example, let's say a house and a flat, and they could have the same gross yield figure. Which one's the best performing? Well, oftentimes you've got things like service charges with flats and apartments, but then you've got maintenance charges with houses. In order to have a true evaluation, we need to be able to plug in both of those different variables into each of the property calculations to be able to arrive at a decision. So anyway, as we'll probably see, yield is really quite a crude instrument, and even if we use the net yield figure, it's only part of the story. Next up is return on investment. Now, return on investment is taking the net annual cash flow, so we've probably derived that from the net yield figure we looked at earlier, and then divide that by the total cash we have invested in the deal. Now, it's important to distinguish when we say the total cash, it is our own money we're talking about here. So I'm not proposing that we put borrowed funds into the equation. I am looking for a return on our personal cash investment. And similarly, when we're adding up all the costs, well, that's exactly what we need to do here. Don't make any distinction between purchase costs and revenue costs and those sort of things. Just add everything together. So it'd be the purchase price, the cash side of the purchase price, refurbishment and conversion works, broker fees, lending fees, solicitor fees, stamp duty, those kind of costs all need to be thrown into the equation. Now, return on investment to me is really the king of investment measures. And the reason for saying this is it allows me to compare investment alternatives regardless of the asset class. So I can easily evaluate whether I should be putting my money into different property deals, comparing one against the other, or even deciding between a property deal and another type of investment. Crucially, it also takes into account the important factor of leverage, which we discussed last time out. So that's pretty cool as well. That said, there is more to evaluating a deal than just looking at the numbers. Although I have to tell you, the numbers do make such an important part of this exercise, well, for me anyway. Now, there is a variation to return on investment that I also use, and that's return on debt. And there's other ways of looking at this metric, but I look at this one, which is, gives us a clue to how sensitive our investment is to changes in interest rates, or in particular, interest rate rises. In order to vary the return on investment calculation to make it relevant for return on debt, all we do is we substitute the cash invested sum that we have for our outstanding mortgage balance instead. So we're looking at our total net return as a percentage of our mortgage balance. Now, hopefully we've got a result there which is higher than our mortgage lending rate, and that's the golden rule I'm looking at in this case. Net monthly cash flow. Now, in order to arrive at a net monthly cash flow figure, we really actually have to start by looking at an annual figure and then reverting it down to a monthly basis. And the reason for that, of course, is that some costs, and indeed some revenues, may only arise at certain points during the year and not necessarily every single month. So it's important to capture all of those costs. A good example of that could be a boiler service, for example, or an insurance renewal, which will probably happen once a year, but it won't obviously happen every month. So all we need to do in this situation is take the total annual rent that we receive on the property and deduct from that the total operating costs. So that would include things like our mortgage payments, it would include the maintenance and insurance and the letting fees that we would have on the property as well. And so that's what we're ending up with. This one's going to be a pound notes figure. Now you may have heard the phrase that revenue is vanity, profit is sanity, and cash flow is reality. And just as with a person, pretty much the main cause of death, sorry to be so morbid, is a lack of oxygen to the brain, and even if this is caused by some other issue. But so too is cash the life force of any business, and that includes a property business. So consider the point, if we always had enough cash to pay our bills, then we can sit out and weather any storm that arises along the way. So even if property prices crash, as long as we can pay the bills, and that means having sufficient cash to do so, then we should be able to ride out the storms and be okay. Cash flow is therefore one of the most important measures as far as I'm concerned anyway. Another one is net equity gain, or sometimes return on works, and that depends on what type of project we're looking at. Return on works is basically the value post-works less the purchase price of the property, less the cost of the works and any fees undertaken, divided by our personal cash invested in those works. So it's important here to make sure we've reflected all of our costs into this equation. Now obviously as I'm speaking this, I'm actually realizing that I'm going through a lot of mathematical formulas, you know, even fairly simplistically, but all of these are going to be detailed in the show notes. They're going to be available on the website. So you don't have to worry about scribbling things down now. Just shoot over to the website, thepropertyvoice.net, head for the podcast for this today's show, and you'll find all of these detailed down. Now this return on works example allows us to, you know, evaluate whether a refurbishment project is worth undertaking or not. You probably know that some works don't actually produce an uplift in value. You know, there are classic ones that do. New kitchens, new bathrooms tend to improve property values. But there are other things in a property that don't necessarily increase the property's value. Some of those we don't have much of a choice with. They may be to comply with regulation and this sort of thing, so we have to undertake them anyway. But the other ones, you know, for example, more expensive fittings may not actually make too much of a difference in the value of the property. And so we may end up spending money unnecessarily and getting very little return. So this is an exercise I always undertake when I'm doing a buy, refurbish, refinance project, or indeed a flip, is to work out how much spend I've got on works and what is a likely uplift in my equity or profits depending on the spend and the return on works figure. Now payback is another measure. Now you might not have come across this too much. It's very often used in a professional setting. Quick definition, payback is the time it takes to return our initial cash invested from the property deal. So with a flip project, this is, you know, how long the property is likely to take, and with a long-term buy and hold, this is likely to be the net monthly cash flow divided by the total cash we've invested to give a number of months calculation. As I mentioned, payback period is one of those investment measures that the professionals use. And if you think about it, which of these two examples I'm about to outline would you prefer? Let's say we have a starting investment fund of £50,000 and we're faced with these two alternatives. Which one would you say is better? Option A is a single project that takes 12 months and generates a return on that investment of £50,000. Now I know that's an impressive 100% ROI figure, but I'm actually using figures just to keep the sum simple. So I'm not suggesting those are realistic figures necessarily that we're always going to achieve on a property investment deal. It's the principle that matters. So quick headline, 12 months, £50,000, return on a £50,000 investment. If you remember the return on investment calculation, that's 100% as I mentioned. Now compare that with an alternative. And this alternative is two projects. Now in this case, we're talking about two projects that each take 5 months to complete and each generates £25,000 each in profit. Now if we just looked at our return on investment calculation, we can quickly work out that this is 50%, 25,000 divided by 50,000, 50% return on investment. So at the top level, we might be tempted to say, well, option A is the better option, because we got 100% return on investment. But actually, in this particular second example, we've got two projects that collectively take 10 months to complete. versus one project that took 12 months to complete. And in this example, just to keep things simple, they resulted in the same financial return. So actually, probably what we'd say is the two projects completed in 10 months is going to be a better outcome. So what we're seeing here is there's a lot of merit in having more than one measure to look at. Some of them give different emphasis and they allow us to cross-check what is actually best for us depending on our current priorities. As I mentioned earlier with payback, deal velocity or the number of times we can recycle our funds might be an important factor. Return on investment is, as I say, the king of investments, and cash flow is really all about reality and survival and protecting the downside risk. So there are three core metrics I would always suggest in any case. Now, I've worked in a number of global or multinational companies, and very often they use quite sophisticated measurement tools like benchmarking and something called the Balanced Business Scorecard that I alluded to before. I've actually seen some, you know, people's list of KPIs that they measure and track, and it runs into literally dozens of different measures. I've seen 35, I think, or something different measures. Now, you know, for me, I just couldn't keep track of that many measures in my business. And for an early stage property investor, I would suggest that's probably overkill. That said, I think it's important to have more than one. And so, as I mentioned earlier, there's probably the top five or so that I've mentioned there. We could probably pick maybe three which are core and which we would class, therefore, as our key performance indicators. So for me personally, I would probably look at return on investment, net monthly cash flow, and the payback period as some of the core metrics that I would actually use. I might use something like yield as an initial screen just to see if it, you know, passes an initial test, but I certainly wouldn't be relying on yield on a long-term basis. And then if I'm looking to undertake works, I'd use some form of return on works calculation. If I'm using a mortgage, I think it's important to look at the return on debt just to make sure I've got sufficient interest cover, as they call it. So that's the KPIs. Let's now have a look at deal evaluation criteria. So what do I mean by this term, deal evaluation criteria? Well, for me, it's a list of haves and non-negotiables that need to be present in a deal to be classed as a good deal for us. And it's best to illustrate this by some example. So factors that I would always look at, well, that we could all look at, let's just start there, would be population, employment, crime levels, transport connections, schools or universities, amenities, inward investment or regeneration, tenant demand, rental supply, and the average time to let. So that's a top 10, if you like, of some of the factors that we could look at when we're evaluating a deal. Personally speaking, I've developed what I call my STAR criteria, S-T-A-R for STAR. And this really aims to take some of these 10 separate items and condense those into some of the more important ones. And I use these in certainly my headline screening of any transaction, just to know that the key fundamentals in an investment property are going to be met. So STAR actually spells out a series of words or areas to look at, and they are as follows. So the S stands for schools. Now for family rentals, this is actually vital. Most families with school-aged children are going to be very interested in the proximity and indeed the standard of schools close to the property. So therefore it's something that we should be interested in as well. Now for student lets, that's obviously not going to be schools but universities. So, you know, reasonable access to the university if you're considering some form of student let. And for non-family rentals, perhaps the equation could be flipped around or inverted, you know, getting spun around a different way. So, you know, for young singles or professionals, being close to a school or university might possibly be the last thing they want. Maybe the university, but certainly not the school. So actually looking at areas where there's not so good schools could provide a clue there as to good location for professionals. So but fundamentally, if we're renting to families and students, looking at things like the school lead tables and catchment areas and the time that it would take on the school run is quite a good thing to consider. Next up, the T is for transport. Now, good transport links are vital for all tenants, and whether that be road, rail or bus, or indeed any other type of transport. But the main thing is to make sure that the appropriate type of transport facility is accessible within an easy way to meet the tenant demand that we are targeting. So there's no point, for example, having access to a bus stop if we're appealing to, say, white-collar professionals, well, at least outside of London, as they're more likely to use a train or a car. perhaps being a bit stereotypical, but I think you get the point. But if we take students as a different case in point, they're likely to want the opposite, and in fact will want to be close to a bus stop or possibly even bicycle lanes. So transport infrastructure improvements are another signal that an area could become more appealing in the future as time goes by. So always be on the lookout for new road projects, train line developments and new tram systems there. So you can think of probably one or two that spring to mind. Edinburgh with its tram, for example, the new HS2 train line connections are certainly two examples where that could bring harder to reach areas into a better sort of catchment area going forward. But, you know, more locally, it's actually, you know, within the golden rule I usually adopt is within 10 or 15 minutes of a major transport connection appropriate to the tenant group. Now, A is for amenities, and amenities is just one of those words that kind of catches a lot of different things. But, you know, essentially it means shops, bars, restaurants, leisure facilities and public services, so things like doctors, hospitals, banks, post offices and that kind of thing. Again, it's important to match it to our target tenant group. For example, the right type of shop or bar is something to consider. But the easy question to ask ourselves here is how far away is X from the property, and where X represents the facility the amenity we're referring to here. So, you know, obviously a local supermarket is going to be something that's very important to a tenant. For a young, you know, mobile, outgoing, gregarious single tenant, maybe they're looking for the bars and the restaurants instead. But I think, you know, it's to weigh up how far away are those things from the property, because people are not going to want to travel too far. The R in my star criteria goes for revenue, which is a bit of a fudge in all honesty, because revenue combines employment or jobs with investment opportunities to get my nice and neat R at the end of star. So it's a bit of a fudge, but basically you get the picture, it's where the money is. Now if we're targeting working tenants, then ideally we're looking for a healthy economy with plenty of jobs. And of course, if we're targeting non-working tenants, then it could actually be the opposite. But always beware, if we're going for non-working tenants, there is a bit of a trap if we go into a very poor area, because if it's poor and economically deprived, then the chances of achieving long-term capital growth may well be stunted. Now, by the term inward investment, what I actually mean is money coming into the local area. So that could be in the form of government spending, or it could be in the form of companies investing in the area. Consider, for example, the effect of HS2 and the Bullring redevelopment is having on Birmingham, or the BBC relocating from London to Salford, or indeed Siemens and other big, you know, green technologies relocating to Hull. All of these, you know, different forms of investment or inward investment are having a positive impact on those particular local areas. On the other hand, consider what effect austerity measures of late have had on places such as the North East, which had an over-dependency on government jobs. And of course, you know, we've seen a lot of government jobs go by the wayside recently, and therefore employment's dived and the local economy has suffered. Alternatively, think about an over-dependency on a single industry and what that can have on certain towns and cities. I only need to mention terms like shipbuilding and coal mining, and you probably get the idea that there's a couple of almost ghost towns now as a result of the decline in those particular industries. So a heavy weighting on any single industry is also not a good idea. So it's a good idea to have a think through these points. Have a look into the types of employers and industries that are in an area. Make sure it's not overly concentrated. And make sure that these are not hard to reach towns and cities from an employment point of view. Now, having laid out all of these nice criteria and key performance indicators, it would be easy to suggest that they're always going to find the perfect deal which ticks every single box in exactly the right way. Now, how realistic do you think that is? Not very. It's very rare that I think I've managed to tick every single box of my criteria and maybe got all of my, you know, my KPIs sorted out for every single transaction I've ever done. It's not realistic. Unless, of course, we've got unlimited funds and we can cherry pick the opportunities that suit us. So there's always, in other words, some kind of trade-off that we need to make. Now, personally speaking, I don't trade off too much. I certainly have criteria which I believe is achievable and is realistic, But I think one of the rules here is to bear in mind that if we're always achieving the, you know, getting over our hurdles or benchmark criteria for every single deal, then we probably haven't set the bar too high, in all honesty. And maybe we ought to have a rethink in that respect. But the opposite is also true. If we're not getting any deals, it might suggest that actually our criteria is too stringent. Of course, we might not be looking too far, but if we're turning away opportunities constantly, it might suggest that perhaps we need to bring the bar down a little bit. So it's just finding the right balance of where to put, you know, that particular bar. So as I mentioned, I have my own, you know, criteria and my own KPIs, and I've developed a number of tools where I score these things out. So very quickly, just in say half an hour, I can evaluate an individual deal, and using tools such as Property Whizzer, which has got an awful lot of the data, you know, population, crime, employment, those sorts of things, you know, at first hand, I can quickly evaluate a deal and work out whether it meets my general criteria or not. Now, if a deal passes my initial assessment, then I can take further in-depth analysis and make further inquiries, and that includes obviously doing a viewing. I wouldn't skip that part of the process. Now, I have actually got another section which looks at due diligence and research, so I'm not going to into a lot of detail in this particular episode about that subject. But suffice to say that if I put my criteria together quite quickly, then I've probably got a go, no-go decision I can make fairly quickly as to whether I undertake more research on that particular property or not. Now, the exercise is useful in a number of ways. One, it helps us define what we're really looking for. So we can say we're looking for certain types of property in certain types of locations that have certain types of return, for example. And aside from having that as a benefit for ourselves and understanding what we're looking for, it also helps us to discuss this with other people. Now, that might be important, for example, if we're discussing with estate agents or say deal sources. If we're clear on what we're looking for, it helps them to bring us the right types of opportunities, and therefore it saves wasting everybody's time. Now, in practical terms, I've developed a couple of deal calculators and checklists that are available to anyone who happens to own a copy of my book, which is the Property Investor Toolkit. So aside from having what I believe to be an excellent property book and resource for the price of a cup of coffee, you also get my personal checklists and evaluation tools thrown in. Now, that can't be too bad at all, can it? Plug, plug, plug. So what makes a good deal for you? Well, what I do is suggest that you sit down and work through your own list of criteria and KPIs that are relevant for you. And in doing so, set your own hurdles, as I call them. So what does the deal need to get over to make it a good deal for you? And then you can undertake some very simple desk research without actually leaving home, just to see if a general area or indeed a general property meets your criteria and, as I mentioned, meets the go, no-go decision that you need to take. As I mentioned, I'll look at research in a later episode, so in that respect, that's all for now. I'd just like to finish this segment, though, by sharing with you how sometimes I've done a deal that does not meet my criteria. So, for example, I've done an overseas holiday let when I said I would only invest in standard lets. Or I've done a property with some personal usage when I say I'm a hard-nosed property investor. Or I've sold a property when I said I'm in it for the long-term capital growth. I have stepped into all of these types of property investment, and they've all had their pitfalls. My criteria, therefore, are born out of these experiences and have been developed over time. If you like, I've honed them based on my mistakes and my learning along the way. Now, I've got to be honest, I haven't lost out as a result of any of these individual investments that I've referred to, so none of them are particularly bad in themselves. It's just that they're perhaps not the best ones I could have made at the time, and perhaps with a bit of blurring going on and a lack of focus at times, which have since sharpened up. I would say this, that potentially I wouldn't do maybe any one of those deals again if I was presented with that same opportunity now. Certainly wouldn't be selling a lot of property anyway. So really, I've honed and sharpened my criteria and KPIs over time, and that's what's going to happen naturally. So the important thing is to set the criteria to begin with, and then we can improve them as time goes by. So I mentioned, you know, it's a good idea that you set your own KPIs and your own criteria. And in all honesty, what I'd be curious is to hear about how you determine a good deal from a bad one. Why don't you share your views within the comment section of the show over at thepropertyvoice.net/podcast. I've also referenced a number of blog posts in the related topics in the show notes, so for you can have a look at as well. But head over there and join in the discussion, or indeed leave me a voice recording on the new SpeakPipe. I'd be curious to hear.
Up next is Your Voice. It's all about you and your property world.
So next up, we have Your Voice, and I've recently had some new technology installed on the website. It's new to me. It's not particularly new technology, but SpeakPipe is a plugin that you can install on the website, and it basically allows a voice recording straight from your computer. So it doesn't need a telephone or anything like that. You can basically leave a voice recording straight on the website. And no sooner I had that than we actually have our first listener question that's been posted of voice recording. So let's have a listen to what Andy has to say.
Good afternoon, Richard. This is Andy from Hogarth Property Services here in Chiswick, West London. Firstly, I'd like to congratulate you on the release of your Property Voice podcast and also the book Property Investor Toolkit. My question to you this week is, with the general election fast approaching now, will we see a surge in London with the house prices, or do you believe a cooling in the market? I'm just a little concerned now with how hard it is for first-time buyers to get on the housing ladder within London without getting some help from what is known now as the Bank of Mum and Dad. Your views and opinions would be very much appreciated, and thanks once again.
Thanks, Andy. Thanks for leaving us that voicemail with that very excellent question. As I see it right now, we are less than a month away from the general election, and so there's bound to be a lot of uncertainty around. Who will be the government from May? Will there be an outright win, or will there be some sort of compromise required and a coalition like we had last time around? Honestly, I don't really know. However, I'm pretty sure that in the lead-up to the election over the next few weeks, there's going to be a bit of a lull in terms of the activity in the property market as people wait to see what happens. So literally in the space of the next few weeks, I probably expect to see activity levels dampen down a bit. That said, and you make a specific reference to London, and London's been bubbling along at a really fast rate of growth in recent years, and so I see a natural cooling, certainly a natural cooling in growth. I'm not necessarily saying there'll be a decline in prices, but there'll be a cooling in the rate of growth of prices, you know, regardless of who gets into number 10 next month. And I think from an investor point of view, there's better options to be had outside London over the next year or two. Sorry about that, Andy. I know you're based in Chiswick, but that's just my personal view. As for first-time buyers specifically, again, that rather depends on who gets in and what their policies are, whether they're the manifesto policies or they become some form of hybrid through negotiation. Now, one thing the parties have committed to is to stay with Help to Buy, certainly for the foreseeable future. And Help to Buy, of course, assists a lot of first-time buyers with deposit assistance. Now, other policies have been mooted, but you know, this is the only one we know for sure anyway that is probably something we can rely upon. Now, in terms of the Bank of Mum and Dad, or indeed the Bank of England, whether they dip into their hand into their pockets to support first-time buyers, it's true that getting onto the housing ladder, and particularly in London, is going to be more challenging due to the rising house prices that we've seen, you know, particularly over the last few years or so. You know, and that has to, I have to say, that hasn't really changed much in principle from many, many years ago when I bought my first property. Deposits still needed to be saved up, and this required both a commitment in terms of saving and some degree of sacrifice. As I mentioned, when I bought my own first home, there was quite a stretch in that respect. Now, it's true that house prices at the moment have been increasing wage increases in terms of their rate of growth. And so I do appreciate that for many would-be first-time buyers, they're feeling perhaps further away from owning a home than they perhaps were before. Although I would say this, things change, and policies such as Help to Buy are evidence of that, as with low deposit or low start and longer-term mortgages in the days gone by. Now, I expect additional products to come into the lending market as the economy strengthens. Therefore, you know, history has a habit of repeating itself, let's say. So don't be surprised if you see a slackening of credit facilities over the next 5 to 10 years. That sounds like a long time away, but when people have forgotten about what happened back in 2008, sure enough, these things will come back again. They always do. But as far as this property, this podcast is concerned, sorry, it is about property, or rather property investment. And so I want to highlight one point here, and that is this, that if we own our own home, that is not an investment, or not in the conventional sense. And I define an investment in the same way that Robert Kiyosaki does. An investment is something that puts money into our pocket. Our own home probably takes money out of our pocket, and so waiting to see if we make a capital gain when we sell it is both speculative on the one hand, and also not that useful if all we end up doing is ploughing it into another, bigger, newer alternative house in the future. So, you know, to be honest, if I was living in London, I might be inclined to use my savings to invest elsewhere, where rental returns are higher. And then I might be tempted to pay rent in the location I am, i.e. London, where rental returns are lower, because it probably means I'm getting better value, if you like, for my pound in that sense. So this, as I mentioned, would imply renting in London and owning a property investment elsewhere. Now, the question of deposits is still the same. You know, either way, we're going to have to raise a deposit, whether we're owning, buying a property or buying an investment property. So we're still going to need those funds for a deposit. So that does need the commitment to saving, as I mentioned. But the key difference is, if we put that deposit money into a rental property or some form of property investment, then it's going to put money into our pocket rather than the other way around. You know, finally, I just want to call out to you, Andy, personally. I know we met at a property networking event, and we've since stayed in contact. I know you're a very positive and very committed to customer service ethos, and you're always looking for ways to grow and learn. And so I really appreciate you taking the time to get in touch with us with this question, and good luck down in Chiswick. Now, if you'd like to have your voice heard on the show, then check out the voice recorder over at thepropertyvoice.net. Or you can use more conventional means. We have no objection to using Twitter or an email, for example, but just get involved. It'd be great to hear from you. Next up is the shout out.
And now, where you can go for more great resources with the shout out.
As you know, we try to feature something a little bit new or different or undiscovered, let's say, in the shout-out segment. And I'm hoping that's the case today. Now, today's shout-out is actually a blogging site from quite an inspirational young man who has the aim of achieving financial independence by the time he's 30. Now, he started in his 20s, and when I tell you, as I mentioned at the top of the show, his original target was to achieve financial independence, which is defined for him as being able to live off his investments completely. His original target was to do that by the time he was 37 and a half years old. That's a very specific date. But I know, and you'll find out if you go to the website, that he's actually revised that target down twice, so to now 30 years old. So that would be pretty impressive, and this chap is very, you know, it's very inspirational, I have to say. Now, the site is called FI Fighter, which is the path to financial independence, and it outlines the investment journey through property and stocks and shares of how the author is planning to get there. So it's got real examples, and you know, part of the reason why I'm sharing that this link rather on this particular segment today is that there's a blog post he's recently written that talks about his evaluation of a deal and some of the metrics and the criteria that he uses. So it's highly relevant as well to today's theme, of course. So the link is going to be in the show notes. Check it out there. But for a quick reference, it's www.fifighter.com. Okay, so that about wraps it up for another week. I really do hope you've enjoyed the show. I'm sorry you've probably had to put up with my voice quite a lot today. Aside from Andy, no Kazza, but hopefully that hasn't spoiled your enjoyment too much. Don't forget to check out the show notes and do get involved in the discussion over at thepropertyvoice.net. And please don't forget your voice contributions either. Until next time on the Property Voice podcast, ciao, ciao.
Thank you for listening today. Now head over to thepropertyvoice.net for more inspirational content and get updates through our mailing list. Join us next time on the Property Voice podcast. And if you enjoyed the show, please don't forget to rate us on iTunes.